From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They went off to war with the Romans. They taught Aristotle how to see humans. They charmed African shamans and Catholic popes. Today, 20 billion of them inhabit the planet. I'm, of course, talking about chickens. Yes, chickens, roosters, hens, little chickies. So just how did the chicken get to be so big? To put it simply, why did the chicken cross the world? And how did it become dinner? The answers will surprise and delight you whether you are a chicken lover or not. This hour, On Point, the humble chicken's exotic tale, it's feather time. You can join us online or on air and ask your most pressing, nagging chicken question, whatever it may be. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Asheville, North Carolina, Andrew Lawler. Andrew wrote a book called Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? And he has been all over the world investigating the chicken's history and discovering that it's worth learning. We've got an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Andrew, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Andrew, how did you become a poultry reporter, a chicken reporter? You're actually more of an archaeology reporter, and that's your main thing. So this was a little bit of a sideline. But how did this all happen?
Well, I have to say I was really reluctant. That's how I began this project. But as you mentioned in your opening, I was given an assignment to follow the bird. So I did, and I was astonished to find out just how intertwined the chicken is with civilization going back thousands of years, it's really amazing how much the chicken has done for humanity in so many different ways across so many different societies. And the value of the chicken today among archaeologists in tracing the way humans traveled across the planet as well.
And how does it play into that? Why is it valuable as a way to trace human development and migration?
Well, one of the ways I tried to answer that question was I visited archaeologists. I went to a site in Kauai, in Hawaii, went down a long ladder into this mud pit where the archaeologists there were finding tiny bones that were actually chicken bones. And below that level, you don't find anything. You find different kinds of animals, but you can tell when humans arrive because suddenly when humans arrive, when the Polynesians in their canoes arrived in the Hawaiian archipelago, they brought chickens with them. So those chicken bones are a marker of the arrival of humans. So if you can't find human bones, look for the chicken.
So just in terms of where you had to go to report this story and write this book, what parts of the world did you get to?
Well, I didn't go to Antarctica because Antarctica forbids all chickens because their diseases might hurt the penguins. But other than that, I went to pretty much every continent, including Australia.
So where did it begin? Where did the chicken start its place on the planet?
Well, this is the big mystery. And even Darwin 100 years ago, 150 years ago, wondered, you know, where did the chicken come from and how will we ever really know? Scientists today have gotten a little bit closer to answering that question, although we still have some mysteries. The chicken is descended from the red jungle fowl. The wild chicken, although that sounds like a bit of an oxymoron, is actually this very shy pheasant-like bird that lives in the jungles of South Asia. And probably somewhere there, maybe in northern Vietnam, maybe southern China, maybe once, maybe more than once, the chicken emerged, that the wild bird, the red jungle fowl, turned into what was to become the modern chicken.
Through what process? I mean, was there conscious crossbreeding or was it more accidental?
Well, this is another mystery. I mean, we know how goats and sheep and even dogs and cats were domesticated, but why was the chicken domesticated? Here's a very, very shy bird that lives in bamboo thickets. How in the world did that become the most common barnyard animal? And there's still a lot of debate among scientists, but what I found was that the best guess is that they actually were not domesticated for their eggs or for their meat. In fact, they probably were first domesticated for religious uses or for gambling, that is, cockfighting.
So cockfighting goes way back.
Cockfighting goes back very, very far. Now, our historical records only go back to maybe the 5th or 6th century B.C., both in China as well as in Jerusalem, actually. They found a number of evidence of cockfighting birds there around that time. But probably it goes back many thousands of years. And certainly Southeast Asia, it's still a very popular sport and has a very long, long tradition.
So this notion that these animals, I'm assuming we're talking about the males, would be so ferocious as to be that combative, so conflicts with the use of the term chicken as a way to say you're scared, you're a coward. How did the cowardly chicken whole story get started?
Well, that's a completely modern idea of the chicken. Actually, one of the first symbols of the Democratic Party was a chicken. The symbol of France is still a chicken. Chickens actually, throughout most of antiquity and up until the last century, were considered to be models of courage. That is, the rooster is a pretty small bird compared to many birds. Doesn't look very fearsome, but if you have ever gotten into a scrape with a rooster, you know that they are incredibly fierce, that they were the symbol of ferocity. And it's only with the kind of rise of the hens, that is, we don't need roosters like we once did. We don't need roosters to wake us up in the morning anymore. And there are artificial ways of creating eggs now that don't require as many roosters. So we've kind of forgotten what the rooster's all about.
How well equipped is the rooster to actually fight a battle?
Well, it's got let's put it this way. About 10 years ago, paleontologists in Montana found a bone of Tyrannosaurus rex. And what was unusual about this bone was that researchers were able to extract tiny bits of protein from this bone, within this bone. And when they compared this protein with the proteins of chickens, they discovered they were identical. In other words, we know now, for a fact, that not only are birds descended from dinosaurs, but that the chicken is directly related to Tyrannosaurus rex, the most fearsome of dinosaurs. So that gives you an idea of the kind of the history of the chicken, and that actually roosters will do pretty much anything to protect their hens and to protect their territory. They're incredibly fierce, like mini dinosaurs.
Do chickens, appear to you to be sort of hybrid creatures in the sense that they have the scaly legs and, you know, a little bit of dinosaur in that and a little bit of bird, and yet they can't really fly? I mean, they can fly a little bit, but they seem like cobbled together creatures.
Well, they do a bit. Although when I was in the mountains in Vietnam, I went on a chase to actually find and see the red jungle fowl, the wild chicken. They actually can fly there. People see them flying for hundreds of yards across valleys. That the wild bird actually could fly a bit more than the current day chicken. So yeah, they are a hybrid in a way, but mainly that's a result of human tinkering.
And what did we do? What did we cross them with to make them unflyable?
Well, we didn't really cross a chicken with anything. The chicken has its own kind of genetic store that is incredibly large and make the bird very malleable. You can turn the bird into almost anything. You had these giant birds that can weigh 20, 30 pounds, and then you had these tiny bantams that weigh a few ounces. So the variety that is possible with the chicken is pretty unlimited. And flying, for example, it doesn't really behoove a farmer to have a flying chicken. So we bred for chickens over the millennia that don't fly because mm-hmm. they can stay at home and they're easier to raise and to slaughter as well.
How did the chickens reach North America if they can't fly?
Well, now this is a controversial question. Now, we know that Columbus brought chickens with him in 1492. They were on the ships. What we don't know is if possibly chickens existed in the Americas before Columbus. Now, in the past, scientists thought no. The red jungle fowl and the chicken are purely they're a resident of the old world, that is Asia and Africa and Europe. But there now is exciting evidence that the chicken actually might have come from the other direction, that the Polynesians, I mentioned earlier, actually may have brought the chicken in their canoes all the way from a place like, say, Easter Island, a couple thousand miles away from the coast of South America, to Chile. They found a bone in Chile which may predate Columbus, which would be good evidence that the Polynesians actually arrived in South America and that it was the Polynesians that discovered America. Now, this is still controversial, and a lot of people say that the bone actually is much younger than it appears.
Well, we have people lining up wanting to make comments or ask questions on chickens, and I want to bring in Jack from Council Bluffs, Iowa. Jack, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Enjoy the program. Interesting subject. I just wanted to make the observation that I really dream of a world where a chicken can cross the road or the world without having its motivations questioned.
Jack, you think the chicken gets a little bit of a bad rap?
Yeah, I do. As a source of food, as a source of protein, I love it.
Yeah, but you don't have chicken pets, it sounds like. All right, Jack, thanks for your call, but I'm glad that you sound like you're on the chicken side. I mean, Andrew, in terms of source of food, I want to talk about this after the break, but just very briefly, the notion of chickens being a large part of the American diet, you're saying your book is a fairly new phenomenon. That's new stuff. We didn't used to eat so much chicken.
It's very new around the world. It's only very recently that humans have turned the chicken from a pretty marginal barnyard creature into the world's largest single source of protein if you combine the meat and the eggs. You know, this is a new development just in the past 50 years.
You work both arms and you work both feet. You together, baby, you run on the beat. You flap your arms and your feet start digging. Then you know you're doing the funky chicken. Oh, oh, it's all right.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about chickens, descendant of the dinosaur, a cultural staple in sport, religion, and more, and trying to break into the conversation behind me. Well, you can join this conversation. We're hearing some exotic chicken stories from our guest, Andrew Lawler, who has spent a long time studying them and discovering all sorts of interesting manner of things about their place in our culture and our history. Do you have any such stories? And what have you ever seen a chicken do that you've talked about later? So Andrew Lawler is the author of Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? And he has been all over the world to learn about them. And a really interesting thing that you write about, Andrew, is sort of the place that chickens have played in kind of the mystical, spiritual life. You referred to this earlier, that the chicken is ironically, for our perceptions, actually a symbol of courage. But there's also, for a lot of cultures, a connection with the divine, isn't there?
Absolutely. I don't think there's another animal that has so many religious and mythological connotations as the chicken, which came as a surprise because I didn't really think about it when I walked by a Christian church and saw a rooster on the steeple. I thought, well, it's a weather vane. But what I learned was, in fact, that has a very long and interesting history that goes back to the early centuries AD when a pope decreed that the chicken or the rooster was the most important emblem of Christianity and ordered roosters to be placed on top of all the churches in Christendom. It's an example of the religious tradition, and that actually goes back to the ancient Persians, who held the chicken in incredible esteem because it would crow before dawn. It would crow before the light came. It provided a spiritual awakening and a reminder that the light would come and that good would triumph over evil. The Romans also thought that the chicken was, in fact, so tied to the divine that you wouldn't think of going to battle without first checking with your chickens to see if they would eat in the morning. If they didn't, then you didn't go to battle. And those Roman generals, those foolish generals who went against what the chickens suggested, were the ones who were defeated in battle. That was old Roman lore. So as far back as you can go, you will find examples of the chicken being used for religious purposes right up to the current day. I went to Crown Heights in Brooklyn in New York and watched as Orthodox Jews wave chickens over their heads in order to expunge their sins before Yom Kippur. It's not just an ancient tradition. Even today, in places as disparate as Crown Heights or the Indonesian island of Bali, people hold the chicken as something special, as something sacred, as something almost human.
We've actually been to one of these rituals in New York that you're mentioning among the ultra-Orthodox community of Jews, and just this past October, the ritual was performed in New York City. And as you describe, what's happening there is that a live chicken is being swung over the head three times, and the sins of the person swinging it are transferred to the chicken. It becomes sort of a scape chicken, I guess. This is not obviously widespread in Judaism. It's really, I think, limited to the ultra-Orthodox community. But all of these things we're talking about, that ritual and the cockfighting, you know, for a lot of people raises the question, and not to mention what we'll get to in terms of how the chickens are actually raised in mass production now, get to the question of the chicken rights, let's say, for want of a better term. And you make a very interesting point in the book that I had not been aware of. The chickens don't have protection under the law that protections under the law that do exist for, say, dogs and horses and other animals. Chickens don't get covered. Why is that?
Isn't it astonishing? I found that there is no federal law that actually protects a chicken if it's raised for food. Now, if you're using a chicken in your scientific experiment, or if you keep a chicken in your zoo, or if you are in a traveling circus and have chickens, there are certain standards you have to go by. But if you're raising it for food, you can do whatever you want. It's considered essentially a vegetable or even a machine rather than an animal, which I found astonishing after piecing together this history where you find humans and chickens being so tied to one another in so many different ways, whether it's medical research or cockfighting or any number of uses that the chicken has had over millennia. But today, we see it as a machine.
Why do you think that, in that sense, the chicken gets no respect?
Well, in part because there's so many of them. There are so many billions and billions of chickens that it's almost like water. We don't even notice them. And they're also hidden away. How many of us who live in cities, me included, see chickens on a regular basis? The vast majority of us do not. And there are many people I've met who've never actually seen a live chicken. So even though we eat chicken, even the word chicken is usually denoted as meat, not even as the animal. You know, I'll have chicken tonight, rather than, you know, at least we say pork rather than pig. So it's an odd fact that while the chicken is so common, it's also almost invisible in our lives. And because they're invisible, I think we don't really think about them. And they're locked away behind fences in compounds that are owned by private companies.
So they're like water because we make them that way, because we're producing them at that rate. How many chickens?
Right.
How many chickens? Do we have a number for how many chickens there are on the planet?
Well, at any given time, 20, 25 billion, you know, give or take a billion. Nobody has taken a census of chickens, so there's no definitive number. But certainly there are at least three chickens for every person, if not four.
And the chicken that reaches the marketplace in this country, you outline in the book that it too has been engineered through crossbreeding to be not like what chickens looked like 150 years ago, that physically they're dramatically different.
Yeah, the chicken of today is not your great-great-grandmother's chicken, or even your great-grandmother's chicken, or your grandmother's chicken. The modern chicken is a result of this intensive scientific and engineering program that took place in the aftermath of World War II. So it's really since 1945, 1950 that we've created the modern chicken. Prior to that, it was a scrawnier animal. It didn't produce quite as many eggs. And before the 1800s, even more so, it was not really a notable foodstuff.
What was the Chicken of Tomorrow project, something that happened after the Second World War?
Well, what happened was during World War II, the pork and beef stocks were designated for the soldiers. So it was very hard for civilians to get the meat that they were accustomed to. And the only alternative at the time was the chicken. But there weren't that many chicken farms, and chicken had never been produced on truly a mass scale. So it was really during the 1940s that chicken farms began to spread across the country, and chicken became quite common to eat because there was no alternative. And at the end of the war, the chicken producers were quite worried. They felt like as soon as the war was over and rations were lifted, then nobody would eat chicken anymore. So they decided to get together and have a contest. And it was sponsored by A&P, which was a supermarket that was at the Walmart of its day. And they decided, we're going to bring together the best minds of the country and get everybody who wants to be involved and come up with a perfect chicken with a big breast that would be able to compete with the pork and cattle producers.
You write, you've become a chicken partisan. I mean, you are, it becomes clear in the book that you're not happy with how they're raised for the most part in this industrial sense. So I know you've talked about it before, but a little bit of a sense of what their lives are like now if they're not running around a barnyard.
Well, I'm a science journalist, and I did not come at this with any agenda. I mean, I walked in knowing virtually nothing about chickens. And so in the course of my journey, as I mentioned, I've seen the way that chickens have been used for millennia, and it really opened my eyes to the connection that and what we owe the chicken, what we as humans owe the chicken in helping us create the civilization that we take for granted today. They really have made enormous contributions. And so as I began to then move into the last part of the book where I actually was dealing with the modern chicken and I went to visit some chicken facilities, I was shocked. Maybe I was naive, but I was really shocked to see that besides chickens not actually counting as animals, they really are treated as machines and that there are no protections. And it was deeply disturbing because of what I'd learned from the history.
Let's bring in Holly from Columbia, South Carolina. Holly, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you.
Sure. You're a chicken fan?
I am a huge chicken fan. I'm really enjoying the show because most people don't talk about them or it's out of sight, out of mind. They're just, you know, chicken. But we are new chicken owners. We have backyard chickens. And that's really the only way I'm even comfortable eating their eggs anymore because, like you said, they're treated like machines. Factory farms are awful. But they're such cool creatures. We love our chickens, and they're hilarious. They get along with our dogs, kind of, and mm-hmm. It's just so great.
Well, terrific. So you only go with the eggs now?
I only go with the eggs, and if I do eat chicken, it comes from, you know, Whole Foods, where they have a humane rating, where they live free range, not, you know, in cages or in the horrible chicken houses that you see all over the South here. And yeah, it's the only way I think you can do it. I wish more people would realize we've tried and opened people's eyes as far as our backyard chickens because they're like, why do you have chickens? It's like, for the eggs, they're healthy. They're not pumped full of antibiotics. They can actually walk on their legs and run and be happy. And, you know, it's just, it's a great thing.
Thanks for your call, Holly. And Andrew, that brings us to the question of the chicken or the egg. And I guess we'll never know which came first, but what about eggs in this whole story? I mean, we've been talking about chicken spreading and having relevance as food for the meat of the chicken, but where do eggs figure into the story?
Well, first of all, eggs certainly come before the chicken. Not, I don't want to give away too much from the book, but eggs were being used by dinosaurs long before the chicken was even thought of.
So we have a solution.
Yeah, absolutely. The egg is this model organism that evolution uses, and dinosaurs pioneered that, and birds today are just doing what dinosaurs did millions and millions of years ago. But one thing that I wanted to mention that the listener talked about chickens and how intelligent they seem. I went to this place in Italy. It was a research facility where a neuroscientist is doing research on chickens, and it was astounding. It was in the basement of an old Catholic convent, and they're doing very basic studies looking at how smart chicks are. And I was astonished to see that it is quite evidence-based, and very simple experiments using balls and small objects, they've shown that chickens actually have a natural ability to count and even to understand spatial relations, that they're almost intuitive physicists and mathematicians. And this is new because people have always assumed chickens weren't very smart, but the new science is really showing that there's a lot going on between a chicken's ears.
Let's bring in Nigel from Cross Hill, South Carolina. Nigel, welcome to On Point.
Yes, hello, John.
Hi. Tell us your connection to chickens.
Well, I might be the black sheep in the group today. I'm actually a commercial chicken farmer, and which I don't necessarily have any disagreements with anything said today. I was just going to add that even though I do what I do typically is looked down upon, that I still have a respect and enjoyment in what I do and being around the chickens every day, even though it's not necessarily always appreciated by our culture.
Well, so but do you have a sense, you know, since you're dealing with a mass of chickens by the thousands, do they all become one great clump to you, or do you have a sense of these as individual, like actually individual creatures?
Yeah, I would. It's a little bit of both, really. I mean, for me, it's a numbers game. Obviously, I get paid for, you know, what stays alive, but you know, usually with each flock that I have come through, there tends to always be a few chickens that usually they're a different color, so they kind of stand out. Typically, mine are all white, and every now and then there'll be a random black or gray chicken in there, and they tend to get my attention.
Do you pick up on what Andrew's saying, that they actually have more brains between their ears than we normally thought? Any personality to them?
Yeah, I think I can see that. And maybe I have a little harder time seeing that since, like he said, I do, I have many more to deal with. But I can certainly see the potential for that on a one-on-one basis, being able to see that.
All right, Nigel, thanks very much for your call. Thanks for volunteering to be the black sheep of the conversation.
I think it's a good point because chicken meat is now chicken meat and eggs, I mentioned, it's the largest source of protein, and there are large numbers of people who produce this to make it easy for us to have that chicken taco with lunch. So I think it's easy to turn the industry and particularly the farmers into villains, which I think is a mistake. I think this is a societal question of how important the chicken is for us and how do we as a society choose to treat it. And this can be handled through public discussion and legislation. And I think we need to have the chicken industry as part of this conversation.
And again, to this whole topic of the chicken's image and it maybe being misunderstood and typecast, you know, there was the show Arrested Development had a scene where Michael, who's played by Jason Bateman, is mocked by his parents and sister for being too scared to ask a girl on a date.
Why does everybody think that I'm scared of girls?
Because you're a chicken.
Chicken. Cuckoo-ca-cha! Cuckoo-ca-cha!
Yeah. What are you doing?
Michael and women? A coodle-doo-ga-da. That's what I was just telling him.
Look, I haven't found the right girl. When I do, I will ask her out. Has anyone in this family ever even seen a chicken?
Andrew Lawler, your question exactly. Has anyone in this family ever seen a chicken? It sounds as though most of us really don't know what we're talking about when we talk about chickens.
Probably not. In fact, a lot of these expressions, you dumb cluck, come from the 1920s. And this is exactly the time that chickens began to disappear, when chickens began to go behind the fences and be less obvious to urban dwellers who started to see the chicken as the kind of the quintessential silly animal that is walking around, doesn't know where it's going or what it's doing. But we know that this is actually not true.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the many dimensions of the chicken. in religion, in food, in sport, and more. And you can join this conversation. Are chickens getting a bad rap after hearing all of this? Do you think maybe we need a new word for cowardice? We're talking this hour with Andrew Lawler. He wrote the exciting new book, Why Did the Chicken Cross the Road? If you're a chicken lover, if you have pets, this can become your manual. And Andrew, there's a whole – we separate these creatures by – menu definitions, where some are called broilers and some are called layers if they're making eggs, and some are called fryers. Talk to me about how fried chicken became fried chicken in the United States.
Well, first, every ethnic group claims to have invented fried chicken. The Romans enjoyed putting pieces of chicken in oil. The Scotch-Irish who came to the United States had a tradition. But nobody quite knew the chicken and how to cook it like the West Africans. And of course, most of the American slaves that were brought over from Africa came from West Africa. So when they arrived, they already had some pretty in-depth knowledge about how to breed and raise and cook chicken.
You also made the point in the book that chicken was one of the few animals that slaves were actually allowed to own.
Yeah, this was quite surprising, and not a whole lot has been written about it. But back in the 17th century, there were a few slaves in Virginia who began to raise cattle and pigs, and with their profits, they were buying their freedom. And this alarmed the Virginia General Assembly, which made it illegal for slaves to own livestock.
Because they could get because they could make that kind of money with
because they could make money and they could they could buy their freedom. And this was going to upset the entire slave system, so it had to be stopped. But the loophole was that they didn't mention chickens. Now, chickens were not a very important foodstuff in early America. We had the native turkey here. We had ducks. We had all kinds of wild birds. So chicken was pretty low on the totem pole. So it was kind of left to slaves. And as far as the masters were concerned, it was good. They could grow their own food. It reduced their costs. And it seemed pretty harmless. Well, the slaves took this as an opportunity. It was one of their few opportunities to use their entrepreneurial experience to actually make some money and to try and gain some form of financial independence. So chickens became a primary source for doing this. And Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, you name it, all of the planters in Virginia and South Carolina as well, often bought chickens from their slaves and would pay them money for that because it was their private property. So over time, the blacks in the South became the general chicken merchants, particularly in the colonial South up until the time of the Civil War.
And they had come in from West Africa, or their ancestors had come in from West Africa frying, and then it just tasted great, apparently. I mean, there's something about chicken and oil that really catches on.
Absolutely. In West Africa, the tradition was to use palm oil. That was pretty scarce in most of the American South, so they made use with other oil. But of course, remember, who was cooking for the masters in these plantation houses? Generally, they were black cooks. They were African-American slaves. And they liked chicken. And plus, there was an economic reason for them to push chicken on their masters, because then the masters would buy more chicken from their relatives or their friends in the slave quarters. So it became a cycle, and more white people began to eat chicken. And finally, in 1824, Mary Randolph, who was a cousin to Washington and Jefferson, she wrote the first Virginia cookbook called The Virginia Housewife. And in that cookbook in 1824 is a recipe that is almost identical to the fried chicken that we know today.
Wow, interesting. So it sounds as though this animal that was disrespected was – that there was an opportunity for the slaves who were disrespected, that the mutual disrespect that the white owners said, sure, let the slaves have chickens, and then that the slaves actually made something out of that.
Absolutely. Not only that, but they were able to kind of inculcate chicken into the larger society, so that now fried chicken around the world is considered the quintessential American dish. And this comes directly from the efforts of African Americans to create the foundation for the chicken industry.
Let's bring in Nona from Toivola, Michigan. Nona, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you. Hi, John.
Hi.
I love chickens,
and I really can't eat chicken after Alice died because we had Ruby and Rosie when my son was about 3 years old, and he would like be eating a cucumber, and then he'd put it out, and Ruby and Rosie would be eating the seeds out of the middle of the cucumber, and then he'd eat some more of the cucumber. It was adorable. And then, I don't know, but 8 years ago, we had gotten this neighbor guy was going to just kill these layers that they weren't laying anymore. Mm-hmm. And so we got two red hens and a gray one. And Jonah, my son, named them Janet and Janet. Those are the red ones. And Alice. And so we had Mean Janet and Nice Janet and Alice. And they were just their personalities. Like,
that was I was going to ask you, Nona, for that word personality. So you really see that with them.
Oh, yeah. And Janet. And, you know, like Mean Janet was mean, and Nice Janet was nice, but Alice was, like, my favorite, and my daughter, Brenda, did not care for her, and Alice knew that because, because they were, like, free range in our yard here and out in the boonies, and she'd always, like, plop some poop right in front of Brenda.
Let me ask, Andrew Lull, are you hearing this story of personality and even vengeance? Do you recognize these chickens?
Absolutely. I went to visit a woman named Karen Davis, who has dedicated her life to protecting chickens. She has an organization called United Poultry Concerns, and I'd heard about it, and she has a website. And so I went to visit her in Virginia, and she lives right in the heart of the chicken industry in the Delmarva Peninsula in Virginia. And at first, I thought she was going to be, possibly an animal rights fanatic, and I was a little concerned. And she took me into her home and into the backyard and introduced me to the chickens, rescue chickens that come from plants or scientific labs that had been discarded or injured or fallen off of trucks, and people just bring them to her home because they know that it's a safe place for chickens. And she walked me through and introduced me to these chickens and showed me how individual they are and the personalities that each one has. And I have to say, I was affected by it. I saw that actually these animals are not just standard issue machines, that they actually do have individual personalities if, like us humans, are given an opportunity to show it.
I want to listen to two ways in which chickens are able to experience their interaction with humans. In the first one, this is from the Philippines, where cockfighting is legal. It's a way of life for a lot of people. And in this one arena, the crowd is roaring and betting as the birds fight each other. So that's one version. And then Andrew, I want to listen to a chicken farmer named Tim Lang. He's a backyard chicken farmer, and he's explaining how he takes care of his chickens.
Usually in the morning you come out, you clean out the pens, you put the water, give them fresh water and fresh food, and collect the eggs from the day before.
So there you have a group of people who obviously you've witnessed these cockfights, you did it as part of your reporting. Nobody's really thinking about the animals, it sounds like, in those situations.
Well, no, it is really about gambling. And the chickens, in a sense, are just the means to gamble. But I would say that the people who raise these cocks, and I went to a number of farms where people raise cocks, and there are a number of those in the United States, although it's highly illegal in this country to fight cocks, that these animals are often treated incredibly well. In places like the Philippines, they will live in an air-conditioned area. They will be fed very well. They'll be tended. They'll be petted by the owner. They actually live really very, very nice plush lives when it comes to chickens. Now, of course, that changes when they go into the ring and only one bird comes out of the ring. Mm-hmm. And millions of chickens are slaughtered in this way in the Philippines, although the numbers surely dwarf the number of chickens that are slaughtered for food.
And then on the other hand, Tim Lang, the backyard chicken farmer, how big a movement is that becoming in the United States now?
It's pretty large, and I think that the numbers aren't as important, and I don't think that movement is going to revolutionize the chicken business because, face it, You know, most of us get our chicken, if we eat chicken, from supermarkets, and only a small portion come from backyard farms. I think what's important about this movement and then it is that it's reintroducing us to this bird so that people can actually see, as the listener said, their personalities and get a feel for these creatures as animals that actually have a more to give than just an egg a day.
Let's bring in John from Austin, Texas. John, welcome to On Point. What's your chicken experience?
Hi, John. Thanks for letting me on the air.
Sure.
I grew up in southern Arizona. It's a rural community, a little farming place, lots of animals all over the place. And, it became clear to me that our relationship to the animals was very, very closely connected with how we perceived them as whether they were food or not. You know, the ones that were not food, we would develop friendships, partnerships, great feelings of affection and love for them. Yeah, I'm talking about dogs and horses primarily. But the ones that were food, people's attitude was more like almost down to hatred. Cattle, range cattle, we hated those animals. And, a cow might get a little closer to us if it was a milk cow. Mm. But chickens were kind of in that range. Even though they laid eggs, and so they might be considered helpers, they were still mostly food. So there really seems to be something strong in the human psyche. If we think it's food, we will distance ourselves and hate it. If we don't, we have a chance of making friends with it.
Wow. John, I've been hosting this show all week. That's about the most profound and thoughtful insight I've heard anybody bring. I really find that fascinating. I want to take it to Andrew Lawler.
Yeah, I think he makes a very good point that when we see creatures as food, we do have a different relationship. And this is why the chicken in the past was seen so differently, because it wasn't primarily a food source. And, of course, this is enshrined in our laws, where we do not protect chickens that are raised for food. There are no animal welfare protections for those chickens. But those chickens that are used in for other purposes like science or in a zoo, they are protected. And we've made cockfighting illegal because we believe it is it's harmful. It's certainly goes against our ideas about animal cruelty. And yet, at the same time, when it comes to chickens raised for food, we have a completely different standard.
Let's bring in Cynthia from Nashville. Cynthia, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thank you. Yes, I wanted to talk about when the personalities of chickens. I had had chickens before, and they were basically, I had just gotten them for eggs. And then one day, about a year and a half ago, I was out and I found some eggs. Hmm. They were lying on a pile of horse manure that I was getting from my garden. And I thought, well, I'll just take them home and see what happens. So I took them home, put them in a shoebox, threw a meat thermometer in there and a heat lamp on them. And 4 days later, out hatches this little black chick.
Wow.
And then this chick has been my pet from then on out. I was her mother. She lived in the house in a cage for 4 months because I couldn't really, bring her in with the other flock, and they didn't really like her, and because of the pecking order. And this chicken now, who we call Gracie, Amazing Grace, is, she's, I had no idea, because you always hear the expression bird brain, but I never knew that chickens could be intelligent. And so Gracie, because she's so bonded to me, she has learned tricks. She comes when I call her. She knows her name. I say, fly, Gracie, fly, and she'll fly. She wants to come in the house still, but I've taught her also how to jump through a hula hoop.
No way, really?
And yeah, she's.
You're not moving that hoop around. I mean, that.
No, seriously. She has certain things she absolutely loves. Like, well, I've discovered she loves fish, so I give her pieces of salmon, or she likes pumpkin seeds, things like that.
Wow.
And so she does go a little nuttier for those types of things. But, the thing that's remarkable is that she really listens to things, And I guess because your guest mentioned having the opportunity, These animals are, when they're just caged their whole life, I feel the same way about any animal. Given the opportunity, you know, they are very intelligent.
All right, Cynthia, thanks for your call. And I find that story amazing, particularly the hula hoop one. But Andrew Lawler, I just want to ask you, after hearing a story like that and after everything that you have done in terms of this research and your understanding of chickens, do you eat chicken?
Well, I have to say that I have made the decision to continue eating chicken, although I'm trying to be more mindful about the kind of chicken I eat. And like anybody, I can get very lazy and just reach for that chicken taco. But nowadays, when I go to the store, I look at the chicken more closely to see where it was raised and to get an idea of how. But we still need some regulations so that we consumers can make easier choices, so that we can choose the chicken that is raised in a more humane way.
Andrew Lawler, author of Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? Thanks so much for being here.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, John.
And you continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up on Monday, Conversations with God, telling the story of two centuries of African-American prayer. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.